This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The conversation has shifted from when to how many and how much. I'm talking, of course, about the Fed raising interest rates. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, January 31st. Good to have you with us. We are not in the predictions business, but lots of economists at big banks and brokerage firms are. And to read their predictions for the coming year, we could see anywhere from 3 interest rate hikes from the Fed for a total increase of 1%, all the way up to 7 increases for a total of almost 2%. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us started with a look at what the wide range of forecasts tells us about the state of the economy.
Raising interest rates is often described as tapping the brakes on the economy. And how many times the Fed has to do that depends on the central bank's speedometer.
The speedometer is really measuring inflation.
That's Kathy Bosjancic, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. She's predicting the Fed will tap the brakes lightly this year, 4 times. That's because she thinks that inflation needle is about to tick down.
Maybe February, March, and then it gradually moderates through Q2 and really slows dramatically in the second half of the year.
If inflation doesn't slow down and the speedometer starts creeping up, the Fed could tap the brakes and raise interest rates as many as 7 times this year. Guy Labat is chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott. Under that scenario, he says,
economic growth is probably still pretty good. Where businesses are hiking wages aggressively in order to get workers, and where inflation is still not yet under control.
Thing is, it's tough to find the sweet spot here. Kathy Jones is chief fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab, a current Marketplace underwriter.
How do you tap on the brakes just enough to slow down to the cruising speed you want to achieve when you really don't know what that cruising speed exactly is in this environment?
Jones says the Fed could slam on the brakes and raise rates by more than expected, but that's risky.
It just makes it harder to finance activity, and that slows down the economy and eventually can lead to a recession.
The Fed is keeping its options open. George Perks is macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group.
And they've also been quite good about saying, look, this is all contingent on forecasts, and we may have a different economy to deal with in the future than we think we're going to have to deal with. So it could be that none of this is necessary. We just don't know.
Perk says how many times the Fed hikes interest rates will depend on what that inflation speedometer is reading every time the central bank's leadership meets. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a not-so-bad finish to a rocky month. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you find yourself bracing for the total at the grocery store checkout these days, imagine buying in bulk. Restaurant owners are paying a lot more for food these days as well, plus supplies and labor. But passing those higher costs on to customers isn't always so simple. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into some of the ways restaurants are adapting.
Jeremy Marin has raised prices at his Cuban restaurant, Havana Central, 10 to 15% since the beginning of the pandemic, and it's still not covering his increase in food cost. But he's hesitant to raise prices more.
I'm selling rice and beans. You know, I'm not selling expensive, fancy stuff. So there is a limit.
So he's cut the menu at his locations in New York and New Jersey in half, which requires less labor and wastes less food. More intricate plates like paella and mofongo were the first to go. It's a tricky balance. Some customers have noticed.
Because we have people who, you know, we've got a lot of regular guests and a lot of them come in and they order the same thing over and over again.
People are really sensitive to change, especially when it comes to price. Doug Roth, a restaurant consultant in Chicago, says the more affordable a restaurant is, the more attuned to pricing customers are.
I would say casual, lower end, you have to be very careful.
So some businesses shrink portions. Domino's, for instance, says it's changing its $7.99 chicken wing deal from 10 pieces to 8. Rick Kamak at the Institute of Culinary Education says shrinkflation can turn off many customers.
If they don't have 1.5 times what they can eat, they feel like they're being ripped off.
Kamak says a more common strategy is not redoing or repricing menus, but rearranging them, hiding dishes with the lowest profit margins.
If I don't want you to buy a certain item, but I want it on the menu, maybe for price value to make it look like the, you know, it's a value sensitive menu, I'm going to bury it in the middle of a column.
There are also those sneaky add-ons. That burger always looks reasonable until you realize you have to add an extra $1.50 for cheese. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The overarching story of the housing market for the past couple of years has been the lack of supply. Just last week, the National Association of Realtors said pending sales fell almost 4% in December, the second month of declines in a row, partly because there are so few houses for sale. Which leads me to a story that caught my eye in The Atlantic the other day about one reason for the housing shortage I hadn't really considered: our collective love of old houses. M. Nolan Gray was the author. He's a professional city planner, also a housing researcher at UCLA. And his piece is called Stop Fetishizing Old Homes. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, I'm just going to get this out of the way because I'm totally guilty of this. You should see my Instagram feed. It's a lot of preservationists. But you think that our love of old houses is a problem. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, I don't think love of old houses is necessarily a problem, but I think a problem that we're not necessarily contending with is the lack of new housing. So we do tend to give special privilege to older housing. There's a lot of discourse about the need to preserve as much housing as possible. And we're really only sort of coming around to recognizing the need to build a lot of new housing and also just kind of accepting the fact that a lot of new housing is actually nicer in a lot of respects.
Nicer, and you argue definitely a lot safer.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, new housing has a lot of underrated benefits that I think people don't appreciate. I think it's fashionable among a certain type of urbanist to look at all the new 5-over-1s that are being built all over the country and complain about how ugly they are.
And yeah, say what a 5-over-1 is for those of us who don't have a lot of them.
Sure. So these are the essentially, mid-rise 5 to 6 story apartment buildings. They'll have retail on the ground floor and multifamily housing for the next few floors. People like to talk about how they're, you know, cheap construction, ticky-tacky. But in general, new housing actually has a lot of benefits over older housing. New housing almost never burns down. Modern fire safety codes are pretty strict. You know, another sort of benefit of new housing is in many cases, old housing actually has accessibility issues. Mm-hmm. And this is something that new housing actually improves on and resolves. Of course, new housing is subject to things like the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Fair Housing Act. And these things require actual units that must be accommodating to people who might be in a wheelchair.
I think we've got to talk about aesthetics, though, because you mentioned the ticky-tackiness. There is kind of a sameness, even sometimes a flimsiness of a lot of new construction that really turns a lot of people off. You know, the vinyl flooring, the hollow doors. Can you have affordably built housing that also looks and feels good? Is that possible?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I mean, I think one word of caution I would start out with is a lot of the beloved housing typologies we have today, people at the time were saying the exact same sorts of things that people now say about those 5-over ones. You know, you can find architecture critics, you know, in the, you know, early 20th century talking about how brownstones are these, you know, cheap, ticky-tacky, repetitive developments, you know. And if you look over Brooklyn, right, there are a lot of these things and they look all basically the same.
Yeah, and they go for like $5 million.
Yeah, well, you know, when you have a mansion within a 30-minute commute of Manhattan and you're not building a lot of new housing, of course, the values are going to go up. We've come around. Over time, two things happen. One is I think we develop an appreciation for crafts that might have not been noticed in their time. That could happen with some of the housing that's being built today. But also, too, you know, the lower quality stuff gets demolished and the really high quality stuff sticks around. So we look back at past eras and we say, wow, if only we could build like that now. When in reality, a lot of the lower quality housing from those eras has been demolished and a lot of what's left is generally higher quality. Of course, that's not always true, as I argue in the piece, but that's, I think, part of why we tend to assume that older housing is necessarily higher quality.
So there's also the environmental and climate impact, though. I mean, you talk about how Japan tears down houses on average after just 30 years, which seems honestly wasteful and unsustainable. I mean, shouldn't we be building homes to last longer rather than just tearing them down every 30 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's a few environmental considerations with the new housing, old housing debate. The first is that newer housing is going to be more energy efficient. Older homes, of course, if you've ever lived in an old home or an old apartment, you know that there are drafts, you know that there are leaks in the windows. If you live in an older apartment in a place like New York, in many cases, you're dependent on a window AC unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things have pretty significant costs. I think another sort of element of this is in many cases, the fetishization of old housing prevents us from adding maybe new housing in neighborhoods where you could have taken an old single family home and turned it into a multifamily building. And by doing that, you would have had more people in a part of the city where they can walk, where they can take transit to work, where they're within bicycling distance of their daily needs. You know, I think that we can have a serious conversation about the climate impacts of new construction. But I think the sort of status quo of treating all new construction as an environmental cost and preserving existing homes as an environmental benefit, I think has the script flipped.
M. Nolan Gray is a professional city planner, also a housing researcher at UCLA. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy. This was a lot of fun.
We want to hear your stories about houses, new and old, for our series Adventures in Housing. You can drop us a line at marketplace.org. Coming up,
I try to keep my price as consistent as possible.
That is not easy these days. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 406 points, almost 1.2% to close at 35,131. The NASDAQ picked up 469 points, 3.4% to end at 14,239. And the S&P 500 found 83 points, just shy of 1.9% to finish at 4515. 2 weeks ago, it was Xbox maker Microsoft buying the video game studio Activision Blizzard. Today, it's PlayStation maker Sony buying Bungie, the creator of the video game franchises Halo and Destiny. Sony scored 4.5%. Microsoft won almost 0.9%. Joe Rogan has heard the kneel and the damage done. The podcaster apologized today and promised his show would be more balanced going forward. He also said he's a huge Neil Young fan. It was, of course, the singer-songwriter who objected to the way Rogan covers the pandemic and vaccines that inflamed the backlash against Rogan and Spotify. company that distributes his podcast. Spotify turned up almost 13.5%. Amazon, whose music streaming service Young touted after pulling his music from Spotify, added almost 3.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's a rare problem in public education. Right now, schools can't spend money fast enough. That is the $122 billion they received last spring from the American Rescue Plan, the big stimulus package. Schools have until September 2024 to use the money to hire counselors, buy COVID tests, upgrade facilities, anything that can help students get through the pandemic. In a recent letter to Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona, several national education groups said they need more time. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
At Claremont Elementary School in New York's Hudson River Valley, fourth grade teacher Stephanie Aldabelli is getting her class ready for the day.
But in front of you, what should you have?
Math.
Your math. What do you have for your math?
Most of the students are wearing their winter coats. Altabelli keeps a few of the windows cracked open, even though it's 17 degrees. It's to encourage airflow in the room. She also relies on what's called a unit ventilator, which looks like your standard metal heater. It's been in place since the school was built more than 60 years ago, and it looks its age. The paint is chipped, and Altabelli says sometimes it blows out really cold air.
And then other times it blasts out really hot heat, and it kind of fluctuates throughout the day.
So it's not perfect?
Not perfect, no.
Replacing these units is a priority of the school district, which received $10 million from the American Rescue Plan. And while that's enough money, school leaders say they need more time to get capital projects like these done.
We all work within bureaucracies.
Sherry Cammy is the incoming president of the School Superintendents Association, which has thousands of members around the country. She's also superintendent of her own district out on Long Island.
There are a lot of hoops that we have to jump through in order to lawfully do capital work in our school districts.
Like drawing up architectural plans, getting approval from the state, and soliciting bids from contractors. In addition to repairing HVAC systems, Cammy says these federal funds provide an opportunity to modernize schools themselves and better prepare students for the workforce. One of her own buildings is 108 years old.
Think about what industry was like 108 years ago. It was an industrial model. People worked in assembly lines. They worked in individual spaces. But when you think about Google or you think about, you know, WeWorks, you think about those industries, they are not designed that way.
But the American Rescue Plan wasn't designed to address the future exactly. It's more about getting through the present and helping students recover from the pandemic. Marguerite Rosa directs the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown.
If in the end this large federal investment doesn't do its job of getting kids back on track, then you know, I think the history books will write that it's a failure.
And right now, schools have 2.5 years to spend that investment. If they don't, that money goes back to the federal government. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace. Years into this pandemic, I know sometimes it seems more like 10, we still don't have a lot of clarity on workplace safety rules for COVID. OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is the federal agency charged with setting and enforcing such rules. The Supreme Court blocked OSHA's vaccine or test mandate earlier this month, and a set of temporary rules for healthcare facilities expired late last year. OSHA says it's working to create a permanent COVID safety standard in response to a lawsuit from a number of large healthcare unions. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, that could take a while.
OSHA says a new set of safety rules, what they call a standard, to protect healthcare workers from COVID could be coming in 6 to 9 months. And even that could be an overly ambitious timetable, says David Michaels at George Washington University.
In recent decades, it's taken years for OSHA to issue any permanent standards around a health exposure.
Back in 2010, when he was running OSHA, the agency started work on something similar, an airborne infectious disease standard in response to the H1N1 flu pandemic.
OSHA has to do a series of analytical exercises. They have to show that everything they're requiring is economically feasible and technologically feasible.
That work wasn't finished 7 years later when the Trump administration took over and shelved it.
So I think one thing that has been made clear is just how weak the OSHA law is.
Debbie Berkowitz, now a fellow at Georgetown, also worked at OSHA during the Obama administration and says rulemaking takes longer than at many federal agencies.
When the law was originally written, Congress thought it would take them 6 months. You know, OSHA must answer almost every comment that comes in. It's a very laborious process.
Because OSHA already did the initial research to create emergency rules, the process could be accelerated, says James Brudney at Fordham Law School. But then will likely come legal challenges.
Those challenges can take a year, even 2 years, to wend their way through a final judgment in the Court of Appeals.
And there may be more of these challenges now that the Supreme Court has signaled a more limited view of OSHA's role in the pandemic. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So remember earlier in the show when Kristen Schwab told us about increasing prices for restaurant owners? Well, how do you run a business that supplies restaurants when your costs change month to month, week to week, even day to day? Welcome to Maine's fishing industry and today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Tog Braun. I live in Bath, Maine, and I am a Maine scallop evangelist. I'm on a mission to show the world what scallops are supposed to taste like. What's different about Maine is that we consist of a lot of owner-operators. A lot of fisheries in the world and the country have gone corporate, and that is not the case in Maine. I specialize in day boat seafood, so that means a day boat is a boat that leaves shore and comes back in the same day, so within 24 hours. And you contrast that with trip boats, which is what produces 95% of U.S. sea scallops, where they're at sea for a week or more at a time. I sell scallops in advance, so I don't have a warehouse. You order my scallops, and then I go out, and my fishermen go out and get them. And my scallops are more expensive than the scallops you're going to get at the grocery store. Sometimes 3 times as expensive as some of the stuff that you might have to try to get the fishermen a better price, because they were selling a premium product at a commodity price. And also, the average American has not had the opportunity to taste this amazing product. The scallop prices have been absolutely through the roof this year. I try to keep my price as consistent as possible. I set my price, I actually increased it a couple dollars because the price was even higher than I expected. But so I set my price in late November, and I like to keep it that way through the season. And it is going to go up and it's going to go down. And this year it's gone up and down pretty drastically, even from week to week, which is a little unsettling, but that's what you have to do. So at one point I was paying $14 a pound more than I was last year. So how do you set your price when you don't know if it's going to be $12 a pound or $37 a pound? It's a little stressful. Hopefully I keep growing, because once people have tried my scallop, they honestly can't get anything else. And honestly, I am on a mission to show the world what scallops are supposed to taste like. And I do that one taste at a time, one FedEx box at a time. But with me, it's a big, the biggest component of what I do is education, because until you know that there's this level of quality exists, you're not going to pay more for it.
Okay, I'm sold. That was Tog Braun, owner of Down East Day Boat in Bath, Maine. We can't do this series without you, so tell us how your economy is doing. Head over to marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, talk about flipping the script. Domino's says it will pay you not to have your pizza delivered. Starting Monday and for the next several months, the company says it'll tip online customers $3 to pick up their orders. The company's been facing a shortage of delivery drivers. I guess promoting carryout is cheaper than raising wages. My question was, do you, the customer, have to report those tips to the IRS? Well, no, because it turns out they're not giving you cash. It's a credit, and you have to spend that $3 on a future purchase. Always read the fine print, folks. All right, we've got to go. But first, your moment of economic context for this Monday. Among the indicators coming out later this week is the latest home ownership rate from the Census Bureau for the last quarter of 2021. Home ownership has fallen during the pandemic from more than 67% overall in the third quarter of 2020 to just over 65% in Q3 last year. And wide ethnic and racial disparities persist. At last count, about 48% of Hispanic households were owner-occupied, just 44% of Black households. And mortgage rates are going up. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.